Rays Radio Network proudly presents This Week in Rays Baseball.
Drilled to center field and deep. Back on it is Eaton. To the track. To the wall. It's gone! Evan Longoria with a two-run home run to straightaway center. And he gives the Rays a 6-4 lead here in the ninth.
Coming up, we'll recap the action from this past week, take a look around Major League Baseball, and sit down for in-depth interviews with the biggest names in the game.
1-2. Got a pitch. Got him swinging, and the ballgame is over as Jake McGee strikes out the side in the ninth inning.
Here's your host, Neil Solons.
And good afternoon. Welcome to our show on this Sunday as the Rays look to win a series in New York against the Yankees. Today, we'll sit down with Matt Silverman, discuss his first year as president of baseball operations, chat with Mark Topkin of the Tampa Bay Times from New York, review the Rays minor league season with director of minor league operations, Mitch Lukovich, and you'll hear Daniel Nava tell his unique story. A lot to come on our show, including Mark Topkin from the Tampa Bay Times joining us from New York. We'll do that and more after this. You're listening to the Rays Baseball Network. Welcome back to This Week in Rays Baseball. Neil Solons with you. Matt Silverman will be coming up, president of baseball operations, in a little bit. Right now, we head out to New York and are joined by Mark Topkin of the Tampa Bay Times. Mark, thanks for being with us on this Sunday.
Anytime, Neil. It's always the highlight of the week.
I would think your highlight was chatting with Stu Sternberg yesterday, and I know you documented fairly well today. What were your big takeaways overall from sitting down in the group with Stu yesterday for about 20 minutes?
Yeah, it was always interesting, I think, and certainly value his accessibility. I mean, many other pro sports owners aren't as available and accessible, and usually will answer any question you have. And, I think it's been interesting to see how Kevin Cash has navigated through this first season. There have certainly been days when many people, including, me and other people in the media, have questioned some of the decisions he's made, and specifically with the pitching. And it was funny to hear Stu Sternberg say that he, too, has had some questions about some of the pitching moves that Kevin has made, and then yet use that as a jumping-off point to just lavish praise on him and talk really excessively about how well Kevin has done this year, how much further along he is than the Rays would have anticipated. And in fact, I thought one of the most telling quotes was Steve Sternberg said that he would have thought if he would have been happy if Kevin Cash was the manager he is now at the end of his second year, at the end of next year. And that's how impressed he is with the progress. So for anyone out there, and there have been a few people who've raised the question via Twitter and email, with Kevin Cash, is he going to stick around? I mean, he is obviously in this for the long haul. The Rays signed him to a 5-year contract, and his bosses could not be happier with the job he's done to this point. So that was my biggest takeaway. A couple other quick things were, Stu Sternberg did admit that maybe he overestimated how they would handle the tough stretch through June and July, and he thought that maybe all those injuries and all that would make them a stronger team for the end of the season. But it sounded like yesterday he kind of admitted that maybe they're burned out a little bit just through the bullpen. Still has hopes for them to make the playoffs. And also in talking about the Kevin Jepsen trade, and that's been a sticking point for a lot of fans this season. And while he said the Jesus trade was about money, he said the Jepsen trade was purely a matter of getting those two young arms from Minnesota with the idea that one of the two, and that's a pretty good percentage, if you hit on one of two prospects, is going to make it to the big leagues and have an impact.
To get back to what you started with Stu, was his praise of Kevin. I think that the Rays documented something really well in their notes today, that the Rays have had a save in 78% or nearly 78% of their victories. The average for the majors is 53%. And they also know this could be the highest percentage in the history of the game since the save was created. So obviously when you're playing close games every single game, more so than everybody else, you're probably going to be more scrutinized than any other manager, I would think.
Well, sure, and I think, if it still holds up, I know most of the season the Rays have led the majors, led the American League, not only in relief innings, but in relief appearances, and those are two different things. And, they've had a stat where they've had the most games with four relievers involved or not. So, sure, the more decisions that Kevin Cash has to make, the odds are that, one of them may go wrong and that there's more reason to criticize him. And also, let's be open about this. Part of the reason that they are so high up in the relief outing standings and the percentage saves and all those things we're talking about is because they're limiting their starting pitchers. I mean, there's several starting pitchers who are pretty much on a 5- or 6-inning leash no matter what. We've seen Nathan Carnes come out of games with just a couple hits. We've seen Erasmo Ramirez come out of games when he's done really well. So the Rays have kind of brought this on themselves to a degree, but the amount of bullpen moves they've had to make and, with not the steadiest group of relievers. I mean, taking Jepsen out of that mix, losing McGee out of that mix to injury. You know, Balfour obviously didn't work out. Frieri didn't work out. So this bullpen has been remade on the fly a number of times this season. So there's been a lot for Kevin Cash to juggle.
Indeed. You wrote also this week and today about what's to be played for. And at the top of the list, a guy that you featured earlier in the week was Kevin Kiermaier. Terrific feature on him. How likely is it, do you think, in this day and age that he does win the Gold Glove? What's your take at this point of the year?
Well, you know, I know a lot of people around the Rays think it's a no-brainer, it's an automatic, it's going to happen. But I think, you know, and not to sound like that old jaded guy, but I've been around enough that, you know, these votes are done a lot of times. You know, people, it's unfortunate, but, you know, the coaches, the manager, it's an inconvenience. It's, oh, yeah, I got to fill out that Gold Glove ballot. Mm-hmm. Who's good this year? And, you know, somebody will throw some names to them, and they'll look at a list of names and don't really pay attention to the stats. And, you know, they remember who played well against them, or they remember, you know, who won it last year or who was good. Lorenzo Cain, obviously, is getting a lot of attention because the Royals are playing so well. Adam Jones has won it the last couple of years. So, you know, there's going to be a kind of an built-in bias for Kevin Kiermaier to overcome in guys that, you know, are playing for bigger market teams, get more exposure, have done well in past years. So I don't think it's by any means automatic. I think it's deserved. I really do think it's deserved. I mean, the mistakes Kevin Kiermaier has made have been mistakes, you know, of over-aggression, basically, where he's tried to do too much. So I do think he's the best center fielder in the American League, probably in all of baseball. But I don't know that that necessarily means he wins the Gold Glove this year.
You touched on it this week in your feature about how good potentially he can be, and opinions from a lot of interesting opinions across the board, and the possibility of trying to extend him. What is your take? How likely is it that he does get extended, and how good do you think he can be as a ball player overall going forward?
Well, to answer the first part of that is, you know, that obviously is a two-party agreement, and the Rays have to be willing to want to extend him. I would think they would. I think they would, in a way, be foolish not to, because he's a player clearly on the upside here and with, you know, a lot of great things potentially ahead of him. It fits the profile of when Rays extend guys, you know, just about when they start showing they can be good and they get some, you know, cost certainty in the arbitration years. They usually buy out a couple free agent years. However, the other side of that is, you know, Kevin Kiermaier has to agree. He has to, you know, be willing to sacrifice the potential for higher future earnings for the security that the Rays would offer in those type of deals. So it always takes a two-party agreement. You know, his agent is Larry Reynolds. He's been around a long time. He was B.J. Upton's agent, and mm-hmm. B.J. Upton never signed a long-term deal. So if you want to add that to the fodder of how this could work out or not. But, you know, Kevin Kiermaier is the perfect guy to do something. He's a humble guy. He's a meager, you know, means growing up. I don't think he is the break-the-bank, quote-unquote, kind of guy. And for a 31st-round draft pick, just to make it to the big leagues, pretty darn good accomplishment. So if a team offered, you know, some money, and I know I made the reference in the story, Christian Yelich seems like a reasonable comparison in terms of age, in terms of accomplishments, and he just got a 7-year, $50 million deal. And I think if you're a kid out of Fort Wayne, Indiana, who didn't think he was going to make it to the big leagues, somebody offered you something like that, that sounds pretty good.
Understood. Matt Moore yesterday was much better. What's your take on how important is this last month for him?
I think it's really important, and I think I included today in my package in the Tampa Bay mm-hmm. Times and on TampaBay.com, Matt Moore among the guys who, you know, in a way is kind of maybe pitching for a job over this final month or so here, because he has to convince the Rays, and what he did yesterday was a good first step, that he can be counted on to be a key part of that rotation next year. Now, he'll have the benefit of the additional rest of the offseason. That's kind of a hard-to-measure quantity now. The Rays won't know that until spring training. Does he come back stronger? Does he come back with more sharpness on his pitches? You know, how will he be in spring training? But he has to show the Rays, you know, over these next couple starts that they can count on him as one of their top five guys, because if not, they've got to make other plans. And right now, they've got a surplus of starting pitchers. I would anticipate them trading at least one during this offseason. And, you know, they have to know where Matt Moore fits into that puzzle before they make any moves.
As usual, good stuff. We recommend people read it on TampaBay.com. Mark Topgood at the Tampa Bay Times, thanks for joining us today from New York.
Anytime, Neil. Catch you soon.
You got it. That's, again, Mark Topgood of the Tampa Bay Times. We turn from the majors to the minors, and one of three affiliates for the Rays organization already in the postseason and advanced to the championship round. That's the Princeton Rays. Their manager is longtime big leaguer Danny Schaefer, who now joins us. Danny, congratulations on getting to the Appy League Finals.
Thank you very much. These kids are excited.
What does it mean to you? I mean, you've been in the playoffs two straight years, and it's been a rarity in Princeton to get the rookie league team to that level.
Well, I've been blessed with some pretty good clubs here. Yes, last year's club had some really good arms. as well as some pretty good prospects. This year club is a little bit different. It's made up of some non-drafted free agents and some picks that weren't that high, but they really play baseball well together.
You've also got some kids who were recently traded to the organization. Eduard Gomez came over in the David DeJesus trade. Alexis Tapia came over in the Kevin Jepson deal. And both of them got wins in that most recent playoff series as you came back from 1-0 down to win 2-1 over Pulaski. Give me your initial take on each because, you know, you haven't seen much of them to this point.
Well, we've seen Tapia pitch against us, and one reason why we liked him because he's young, he's 19, he's got a good arm, mid-90s fastball, and he's got some pretty good off-speed stuff. He showed up last night big time, gave us six strong innings, and really didn't pitch out of the stretch until the fifth inning, and did a real nice job. Lopez is a little bit different. He came from the Angels, I believe, and he came out of the bullpen the other day to get a four-inning save and did really, really well. Both have good arms, both are love to pitch, and they fit the profile here really well.
You know, last year when I had you on the program, you immediately highlighted a kid from that club, Brent Honeywell, who's emerged not only in this Rays organization, but one of the game's top 50 prospects. I know you said you have a different team this year, but who among the guys who are in this organization have emerged perhaps a little bit and have kind of stood out?
Well, from this team, we got a 19-year-old in center field with Zach Wall, and he's been a mainstay at number two in the lineup, and to hit .270 this year, he did hit eight home runs and stole 12 bases, and he profiles pretty well. I mean, I look at this kid, and he has a lot of similarities to an outfitter I had when I managed in the Cardinal chain, and that's Skip Schumacher, and if he can do what Skip has done in the major leagues, he's going to be a very, very good player. We have a few other players, too, that have had great years. David Rodriguez behind the plate, his red flag coming in is could he throw and would he be able to stop the running game? And as the year progressed, he's thrown out 51% of his runners and he's hit about .270. So he's coming as well. We do have a lot of good players on this team, but nobody really, really stands out other than maybe Zach Wall and Brett Sullivan, our third baseman, but they all play very well together.
And you also have had to kind of meld. You get kids you mentioned, non-drafted free agents, guys who sign. How difficult is it, and what's the big message you try and send as guys start as professionals in their career?
Well, the draft is not a science. I mean, I just heard you talking about Kevin Kiermaier, mm-hmm. a pick that wasn't very high, and he's going to be a very productive major leaguer for a long time. Of course, the ones, twos, and threes we expect to advance through the system, but it's not a science. And once you get through 40 rounds, there's a lot of players that are still out there that are capable of playing at a high level. And, they're diamonds in the rough, and, it happens every year. There's people that are not drafted, or there's people that are skipped to the 20th and 30th round that end up being big leaguers. And the message is that we send is once you have a uniform on, you may have a couple of years that you get a free pass if you're a real high pick, but once you have a uniform on, you got just as good a chance as anybody else to play in the big leagues.
Well, it's certainly an important message, and it comes from a guy who's been there and been successful, and certainly you're doing so as well on the managerial side. We wish you best of luck. I know you're about to get on the bus to head to Greenville to take on the Astros. Hopefully we can touch base with you after the championship round, and hopefully we're talking about a championship for an affiliate in the Rays organization.
Hey, that'd be cool. Thanks, guys. Appreciate the call.
You got it. Again, that's Danny Schaefer, manager of the Princeton Rays, on to the Appy League Championship, a best of three series which begins tonight. Before we continue on This Week in Rays Baseball, let's pause for a station identification on the Rays Baseball Network.
The home of Rays Baseball, 620 WDAE St. Petersburg and 95.3 FM.
Neil Solon's with you on this Sunday on This Week in Rays Baseball. When we return, we've got a lot to come, including Daniel Nava and his story, Mitch Lukovic on the Rays' entire minor league system. But coming up, Matt Silverman, president of baseball operations, after this on the Rays Baseball Network. Welcome back to This Week in Rays Baseball. Our featured guest this week is president of baseball operations, Matt Silverman. Matt, first of all, congratulations. Not too long ago, the birth of your second child, another daughter. What are you losing more sleep over now? The fact that you're into September and
the race is there, or the fact that you're just not getting much sleep from second child?
Yeah, this is the time of year we don't sleep that much, although I'm not sure when we do sleep. So having a newborn up doesn't disrupt that much. That said, she's a great sleeper. She's been a very cooperative two-week-old, and hoping that's a good sign for the future.
You certainly had your challenges, not only balancing family life, but also July trading deadline, August trading deadline, September call-ups. Which has been the hardest part of all this?
The July deadline was a tough one. Just so many different conversations going on. August is a little bit more controlled, given that there's only a certain number of players out there at a certain time. And many of the players that we put claims on, we don't even get. So not as many conversations. It was a good approach. Our goal is to make sure this team has enough to get through the rest of the year, to make sure that we give this club a chance. At the same time, we're always making sure that we're keeping an eye on the future. And that's what we're always balancing. You see it in the moves that we made in July, see it in August, and probably what we'll end up doing in September also.
And we'll certainly touch on and backtrack a little bit, but you've had a lot of learning opportunities during this season. What have you learned the most in your first full year as president of baseball operations that you didn't know being on the business side?
I think one thing that's very different this year is just the number of transactions that have taken place at the major league level, the minor league level, the roster maneuvering because of the injuries that we've had and the way we've utilized our players has been different. It's been challenging. It's been invigorating in a way. It means great communication from the major leagues to the minor leagues, the coaches to the clubhouse, throughout the player development system. I think we've gotten better at that. There's room to grow, but in terms of staying on the same page and being unified, we're doing a really nice job.
What did you learn about yourself, about this role that you didn't know?
Well, what I knew, but I even know better now, is that we have an incredible team in place. And what's been built here over the past decade is a really well-oiled machine. There are places where we can improve. There are places where we can further explore. But the foundation and the core that we have is great. And we've relied upon that with some new faces added in to produce the results that we have this year and feel really good looking forward.
One of those is Kevin Cash, and it's new, the relationship between the two of you on a daily basis. How challenging has it been? What have you both learned, you think, about one another?
Now, well, we've learned that right after a game ends, especially when we lose, is probably not the best time to sit and talk and debrief. But we decided that before the year started, that we'd go ahead and wait till the next day to get into a lot of the nitty-gritty. The communication is constant. It goes back and forth. But neither of us is afraid to have the tough conversation to address any conflict. And I think Kevin is taking that into the clubhouse, too, where he's not afraid to have tough conversations. It doesn't mean that he doesn't love someone, but you need to have those conversations and address conflict. And I think it's helped the clubhouse atmosphere this year.
Certainly you were hoping for certain things when he came in. What have you learned about Kevin? Because this has been the most challenging year in terms of injuries and transactions.
His energy level has been really good. It's been high. He's been optimistic even when we've had some tough stretches. And what I've seen even more than when we interviewed him is the competitor. He wants to win. He wants to win badly. And I think that's rubbed off on this club. They see how much he wants to win, and it inspires them to go even further and be even more competitive. At the same time, he can cut up with the best of them. He's got a lot of jokes on the bench. He keeps things light and keeps everyone engaged in the game. And those are strengths that you don't know until you actually see him manage, but it's been pleasant to see that.
If I were to tell you that you'd have 27 DL stints by the start of September, Alex Cobb would never throw a pitch, Jake McGee would go on the DL twice, Drew Smyly would have a handful of starts, and on and on and on, where would you think this team would have been at that point?
I would have thought that the goal of meaningful games in September wouldn't be achievable. But we've really tested the depth of our system, the talent level. We've seen guys step up, and it's really helped us have a better sense of what we have looking forward. Certainly didn't want these injuries. I think our club could have performed better if we had had a healthier club, but we've been able to turn it into positives. And we're sitting here beginning of September. We're still in it. We're one hot streak away from being in the second wild card. And once you're in the dance, you have a chance to win it.
Injury equals opportunity in a lot of cases. Who is best taken, or what players have best taken of the chances they've had to produce here because of injury?
You know, Logan Forsythe certainly stands out as someone who wasn't envisioned as an everyday player when we looked at the opening day roster, but we thought had the talent level to do that. And given the opportunity, he has really seized it and shown an ability to hit well, play incredible defense, and stay healthy and stay on the field. And that durability has been really important. The positional flexibility helps, but you know, we have a guy who we believe in and has really stepped up with that opportunity. You know, Alex Colome is someone else who, in a different way, had an opportunity to go into the bullpen because of a number of injuries and situation. And rather than looking at that as a demotion, which is not, he has really embraced it, and we've seen a different pitcher. We've seen a guy who is excelling, and whether he's in the bullpen or in the starting rotation next year, I expect he's going to be an even better pitcher because of it.
You've mentioned some players who've certainly excelled. In terms of units, where do you think you had more than maybe you thought you did initially, because certain positions or certain places in the field, you did better with all the injuries you had?
Yeah, on the pitching side, we've been able to give some guys some opportunities and see pitchers like Matt Andrees step up and develop while on the job and show, you know, that he's got a really bright future for us. Erasmo Ramirez came in as a question mark for the industry. We had a lot of faith in him, and he's gone out, especially after those first couple outings, and shown us that he can be a reliable starter who can go out and compete and give us a chance to win every time he takes the ball. So on the pitching side, I feel better about our depth, and we have some other youngsters who are going to be going to be coming on the roster later this year. That's going to be part of our future wave, and feel better just about that group as a whole. Secondarily, we have a lot of infielders. And Nick Franklin has had a season marred by injury, and we have a lot of confidence in him. He's hitting really well in AAA. You add him to the mix of players that we have, so many good infielders, it's going to be a good problem to have next year to work through that glut of infielders.
In terms of things that you have great needs for next year, what would top your list then, based on what you've seen from a depth standpoint, from what you know about the system?
We actually feel pretty good about our roster and looking ahead, that we don't have that many big holes to fill. And a lot of those will be done internally. That's the way we do things. We don't go out and sign the big free agents to fill holes. We hope that we have those guys internally and give them opportunities to show what they can do. Just looking at our roster overall, we're much deeper on the pitching side and on the infield side. Outfield, we feel good, but there isn't the same level of depth that we have in other areas. So I expect that'll be an area of focus for us. But the good thing is we have that pitching experience. We have the pitching talent and depth there, and that's a great foundation to have.
The thing that I usually hear about on postgame shows is having power. And obviously, Evan has not had the year you would have anticipated in terms of that. Steven Souza Jr. was hurt. Richie Schaefer has shown it in the minor leagues. We don't know yet at the major league level. You've got 20-plus homers beyond what Kansas City's done, but they've been able to score a lot more runs. How do you try and maximize the run scoring aspect to go along with the run prevention you've put forward?
Yeah, run prevention is going to be our bread and butter, and that's pitching and defense. And we look for the timely hits. Some of the power guys that we thought we were going to get production from just haven't been as healthy, and Desmond is someone you didn't mention, but we expected to have 10 to 15 home runs from Desmond Jennings. We expected more from Souza if he had been able to stay healthy. Longoria, lots of doubles, not as many home runs, but those things can flip very easily. It really comes down to sequencing and getting those timely hits. And at times this year, we've really struggled with runners in scoring position. Don't think it's because of a poor approach. I think a lot of it is just bad luck, bad outcomes. And those are the types of things that over the course of time can revert back to normal. But we've had some bad luck in those situations. If it reverses itself, we'll be scoring more runs in the future.
And you did during the course of the Baltimore series. Again, we're chatting with Matt Silverman on This Week in Rays Baseball. Fans always have other questions during the course of the season, and I think probably the trading deadline was where I probably got the most questions. And as you can understand, it was around Kevin Jepsen. Can you explain further about looking at the future and the present and why you did what you did at the time?
Yeah, that was a very difficult one, not just because of Kevin's talent, but because of what he meant in the clubhouse. And he, in a short period of time, became a strong voice and a leader in our clubhouse, and especially with the bullpen. A very difficult decision. And it's one where we have two pitching prospects in return who we think are going to be very important to our future, and we can't ever be naked on the pitching side. If we had known that Jake McGee was going to go down under injury and that we'd be thinner on the relief side, maybe it changes the calculus, but we didn't have the benefit of that knowledge. At the same time, it's given Alex Colome the opportunity to step up and show what he can do, and we've been able to add some reinforcements from Durham in September. Hopefully we'll be able to weather that, have the bullpen as a strength, but certainly we've missed Jepson and the performance that he had given us in the past.
You do have or have gained Matt Moore back. How much closer is he to where he was from 2 years ago, and what can he be going forward? Because in 2016, you probably need a good Matt Moore.
Yeah, and we need a good Matt Moore, and we believe that Matt Moore is back. He scuffled a little bit in some of his early starts here. It's hard to come back from injury. It is, especially with that long of a layoff, and then to come back in really tight games at the major league level. That transition is not easy. And so going down into Durham, get a few starts, get back into a rhythm and a tempo, and get his confidence back up, that's what we thought was needed. He did a really nice job embracing that challenge, and now he's ready to come back up. I think these next few starts will be important ones for him to build his confidence and head into next year and know that he's a healthy pitcher who can go out there and be an everyday starter for us.
And it looks like you've gotten some of that from Drew Smyly with the big start he had in Baltimore this past week. With Alex Cobb down for the year, how much can you really expect from him the back end of next year, knowing what you dealt with Matt Moore and knowing how difficult a surgery it is to come back from? And how does that figure into your planning for 16 and beyond?
Well, you know, we know the challenges of the surgery rehab. Alex is doing a great job. He's very disciplined. He's very focused on it. And we look for him to come back sometime around the same timetable, maybe a little later than Matt Moore. His performance is going to be a bonus for us. We can't count on it, but if he does his work and his body responds the way it can, he can be a real asset for us down the stretch next year. And to add him to the guys that we can have, that we expect to have in our rotation, it'll be a good problem to be juggling 6-7 starting pitchers, just like it's a good problem right now to be juggling those extra pitchers that we have.
Best of luck with the juggling act down the stretch. We certainly appreciate a few minutes, and this week in Rays baseball, and hopefully you get some sleep too.
All right. Thanks a lot, Neil.
That's Matt Silverman, president of baseball operations. We'll continue right after this. You're listening to the Rays Baseball Network. We continue on this week in Rays baseball, and our feature guest this week is Daniel Nava. And Daniel, we've had, I guess, a few weeks now to start adjust to a new place, a new clubhouse, new teammates. How comfortable have you gotten, and how different is this than what you had in Boston?
Well, it was really easy to get comfortable. The clubhouse and the feel of the guys and how friendly they were made it almost like a seamless transition. Obviously, I still had to introduce myself and things like that, but a lot of guys came up to me and went out of their way to try to make me feel welcome, and that goes a long way when you're coming into a new environment, whether it be players, coaches, front office. They did do a really good job of just welcoming me and embracing me.
You were part of obviously some very good teams in Boston. How different are the celebrations after a win there versus here?
They're completely different. It's just different team. I guess they do different things, and so this team has their own routine, I guess you can call it, that they do after they win, or that we do after we win, and it's fun, it's enjoyable, it's different for me, and I think anyone else coming from a different environment would say it's different, but I'm not saying it's bad, it's just different, but it's a lot of fun.
Is there anything that stands out to you? Obviously, you've heard all the kind of stories, and have you found a way to fit into the celebration yet?
Oh, the celebration kind of fits you in based off of what happens during the game. So whether you're a key role or you play a key role in the game, you might have a little more prominent, I guess, role in the celebration. And if not, everyone's involved. But your role in the game, it definitely impacts the degree to which you participate in the post-game celebration. But the point of it is just to bring the team together, and the point of it is to have some fun and to lighten the mood that, you know, we're playing a game and, you know, let's focus on today. Oh, today's over. Let's focus on tomorrow. Let's go get them tomorrow.
You will get to face your former team on the next homestand and also on a late season road trip. Is that going to be strange at all for you? And which part of it would be the most challenging, being at Fenway or doing it here?
I mean, of course it's going to be different. I mean, that's the only organization that I knew for almost 8 years. And I actually just saw Zobrist, and he was saying, you know, I was with the Rays for 9 years, and they get traded, obviously. It creates a different dynamic to play against your old team or the team that gave you a shot from the beginning. It's going to be, for me, it's going to be fun. I was grateful the Red Sox gave me a chance years ago, and to go back to Fenway and just experience that from the other side is going to be different. But I still have a lot of friends on the other side. But I mean, everyone, I guess, is aware it's a business, and sometimes, or actually, well, nowadays, a lot of times these things happen. So you just keep in contact, keep those friends, but you still want to go out and beat them and win.
Your story to get to this point is a unique one that I'm not sure that most of our fans realize how long it took you and how hard the work was to get there. Walk us back all the way to, I guess, Santa Clara and your story there, and then kind of move us forward.
Okay. I graduated high school and went in California. I went to a private college called Santa Clara University in Santa Clara. And I walked on there to try and make the baseball team. Didn't have a scholarship or anything of that nature, and I got cut. And I figured I was done because in high school, I didn't play that much. I was really, really small in high school. So I thought,
when you say small, I had read, what, 5'2", 5'3"? Or?
My freshman year of high school, I was 4'10", 72 pounds. And I only know that because there was one kid that was smaller than me, and so I held on to my 72 for each and every pound because he may have been 69, 68 pounds, and so, hey, I was 3 pounds heavier. And at that time, it was a big deal because when you're the smallest kid in front of school assemblies, you'd be the guy that they threw up in the air and did all the whatever, like aerial tricks and stuff. So since I was second smallest, I didn't have to do that. But yeah, I was 4'10", 70 pounds. I graduated about 5'5", 150, but I wasn't a type of guy who was strong or had actually put muscle on. So when I went to college and I tried out, I was very small and overmatched against Division I athletes. So I got cut, and I thought my playing days were over just based off my history. I didn't play much in high school. I got cut in college. And at the time, Santa Clara was not one of the prominent D1 programs in the country, and if I got cut from a program which was struggling, I figured that was a good sign. So I stayed on as a team manager because I did love sports, and I still do, and I wanted to be involved in baseball and some sort of maybe potential front office sort of situation. And the head coach had connections, so he said, we'll kind of make a trade-off. You do the team manager job, wash uniforms, help set up the field, whatever needs to be done, and eventually when you're done graduating, or if you graduated, I'll have a connection for you within some sort of professional affiliated baseball team. And so that was kind of the trade-off that I did for that 2 years.
And then you went to junior college, right?
Yeah, I went to junior college because our family, we couldn't afford the college anymore. And I left Santa Clara, ran into a buddy of mine at a gym. But the difference is that between my freshman and sophomore year, I had grown to like what I am now, and I had resigned myself to just playing basketball and lifting weights and going to school. And between that freshman year and sophomore year, I'd grown and able to put some weight on, and I was like, whoa, I'm 5'10", I'm about 190 pounds. And so when I went back my sophomore year to Santa Clara one day, just got done setting up the field with all the coaches, and all the players were going to come out in 30 minutes. They're like, well, why don't we just take some BP and have some fun? And coaches still want to have some fun. So there were a lot of ex-professional baseball players, and they're all hitting these taters. And I'm like, wow, well, let's see what I can do. And I picked up a bat, 34-inch bat. I hadn't ever picked up a 34. And I started hitting balls, not just out of the infield, but with some pretty good distance. I'm like, this is amazing. So when I left Santa Clara, and went to this junior college, I ran into my buddy, like I said, at the gym, and he said, what are you doing? I'm not doing much of anything. You want to come try out at the junior college? I mean, you got nothing else to do. And I said, yeah, why not? So I went to this junior college, College of San Mateo, and I tried out there and walked in the head coach's office, and he said, hey, so when was the last time you played baseball? I said, pretty much about 3 years ago, and his jaw kind of dropped to the floor. He's like, all right, well, good luck, go get him. And fortunately, I made the team, and I played 2 years there at that junior college, and then I got a scholarship back to Santa Clara to play baseball there, and I needed one. We couldn't afford it, so I had to get a scholarship, and fortunately I was able to get a scholarship back to Santa Clara.
And then you had to go the independent route after that.
Yes, so I went to Santa Clara. And fortunately, when I did come back and start playing, I was able to play well and I performed well. But just the unique road that I took, a lot of teams, colleges, whatever it was, coaches, had a lot of hesitation to take a gamble on me because I came out of nowhere. So I did really well junior college. Numbers and stuff aside, it doesn't matter. I did really well enough to get me a scholarship back to Santa Clara. Then I won the batting title at Santa Clara, hit almost 400, didn't get drafted. So I actually went to independent ball teams, two of them, and tried out, and I got cut by both of them. And so I said, if I'm going to get cut by independent ball teams, there's nothing else for me to try out for. So I just I was working out in hopes that I'd get an open tryout with somebody anywhere. I called a bunch of independent ball teams throughout the country, seeing if there was opportunity. There was just no opportunity. So I was in shape. I was still hitting. I was still working out. But I had no place to play, so I just played co-ed church softball. And about halfway into our season, rigorous season, let me tell you, I got a call from one of the independent ball teams that cut me a year prior, so this is a year later. And they said, we'd like to have you come try out. So I went to the Chico Outlaws. My manager was Mark Parent at the time, and he's now the bench coach for the White Sox. And I tried out for them. And made that team, and I played for them from 2007 for one season.
And then you got your opportunity with the Boston Red Sox organization to play affiliated baseball.
Yes. After that season, the Red Sox purchased my contract for $1 from the from my independent ball team. And I guess how it works is if you make a team out of spring training, then they essentially say, all right, then we'll pay the remainder of, what, $3,000, so we'll pay $2,999. I don't know what my contract was, but that's just roughly how it works. So $1 to purchase the contract. If I don't make the team, I go back to the independent ball team. I'm their property. So I made the team out of spring training, and I played for the Lancaster Jethawks in 2008. And what I was told is I was just there just to be a roster filler, and if someone got hurt or someone needed a day off, I would play.
So you go from a roster filler to not only making the big leagues, but you hit a grand slam, the first pitch you ever saw. Can you walk us through that moment and what it meant?
Oh, man, yeah. So eventually I got a chance to get called up, and I remember walking to Terry Francona's office, and he was an amazing manager, and he said, you know what, just go out there, have fun, soak up today. Don't even worry about going out there and being the guy, because we have plenty of guys in this lineup who are Hall of Famers, et cetera, et cetera. So just have fun. So I walked up to the plate, but the bases were loaded. And, I was nervous. I never played in front of 37,000, 35, whatever. It was a packed house against the Phillies, and I never played against that many people. And fortunately, first pitch I saw, I was just trying to hit a sack fly the outfield, have that first at bat, you know, just be a productive at bat. First pitch I saw was a fastball middle in, and I did a lot of praying before. Just God help me not to look like a total clown right now. And fortunately, I hit the ball, and I thought it was sack fly. It kept going, and it went all the way out, and I was blown away. I just tried to make sure I touched all the bases and didn't trip.
Your story, obviously, is a tremendous one. Two things on that. One, what ignited your passion for the game, and who did? Because to be able to persevere like you did, somebody along the way had to ignite some level of passion for baseball.
I think my... between my dad and my grandpa, who both were athletes in their own regard, not necessarily, my dad was more a football player, my grandfather was more of a baseball player, but, you know, I always loved sports. It was just something that I enjoyed, and so growing up and just loving to do sports, whether football, basketball, soccer, anything, you know, you're a kid, you just want to get outside and have some fun, so that was part of just growing up for me. And then I wouldn't say anyone, like, lit that fire. It's just part of everyday life. Just the same thing as sitting down having breakfast. It was like, all right, we'll go outside and play catch. That's something that we would just do. But I guess the older I got and the more that I got a chance to just see, like, the opportunities that it could lead to, or something I wanted in education. And then the older I got with professional baseball, just to see how long I could play for. So it just kind of built on top of each other. But sports was always something that I enjoyed.
And the story itself... You know, I've watched the movie Rookie a million times. I broadcast in Durham. Why hasn't your story ever become a movie or a book to this point?
Well, hopefully I'm still going to play for a while longer, and then who knows, maybe after that can be something that happened. But right now I just want to focus on playing. There have been opportunities, but I think that time will come, but right now is not that time.
Is Daniel Nava, certainly a terrific story. Reminder that you can display your love for DJ Kitty and the Rays in your home or on the road with the DJ Kitty plush window cling presented by Tradewinds Island Resorts. All fans receive the DJ Kitty giveaway while supplies last on Saturday, September 12th. As the Rays take on the Red Sox, for tickets, all you have to do is call 888-FAN-RAYS or visit RaysBaseball.com. We'll have more coming up. You're listening to the Rays Baseball Network. We continue on This Week in Rays Baseball. Time to turn back to the Rays minor league system. And joining us now in this final weekend of the regular season is Director of Minor League Operations, Mitch Lukovich. Mitch, three teams in the postseason, an outside chance for a fourth, and your top six affiliates could all end up at 500 or better. To you, what's the biggest highlight in the system from your standpoint?
Well, you know, one, you want to have meaningful games in August. And when you have clubs that are above 500, they're playing good baseball in August. You're having guys like Snell, Schaefer, prime prospects that are playing well. That's a big deal for us. Pulaski, you know, the Princeton Ball Club beat Pulaski last night to go in the finals. That's a David and Goliath type of matchup. They were or had the best record. So when kids have meaningful games in August and prime players are playing well, that bodes well. We're really happy about that, Neil.
And we had Danny Schaefer on earlier to talk about the Princeton win yesterday. Obviously, you've got Charlotte and Montgomery going into the postseason, and Charlotte and Montgomery are set up by halves, and you've got a lot of kids who played on both those clubs who helped the team qualify for Charlotte first half playoffs and Montgomery second half playoffs. I would guess you've got a pretty good core that a lot of guys you think have a chance now.
Well, the nice thing is with promotions in our system, you know, there's a lot of guys on Bowling Green that are going to play with Charlotte now in the playoffs that, you know, merited opportunity, like Honeywell and Justin Williams, just to mention two. But also the Charlotte Ball Club with Jake Bowers. And, of course, Snell was with all three clubs at Durham. Guerreri, Stanek started out in with our Charlotte club, pitching for Montgomery. So it's nice to see guys get promoted. They get promoted because they're proficient at a level, and now they take that to the next level. And now Montgomery got better, actually. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with Charlotte, it's going to give a lot of Bowling Green kids an opportunity to play in postseason play, which we love.
You mentioned Jake Bowers. He's only 19. This week you announced your fall league kids. What does it say about him that he's one of the kids that you're sending to the fall league? He's still considered a teenager.
Well, he is. He's 19. He's league age 19. Most amazing to all of us. Jake has it. You know, he has the ability at the plate to have calmness throughout his at-bat. Now, if he has a bad at-bat, he goes out to first base, and with that, he handles it. He doesn't take his at-bat to the defensive side. If he has a bad at-bat, he has a chance to get a hit the next time. The game doesn't – he's not on a roller coaster, so to say, Neil. And when you talk about a 19-year-old, that's a really, really rare. And, you know, we're fairly progressive or fairly conservative, I should say, in movement when you have a 19-year-old there. Wow, that's exciting for him and for us.
And it obviously says something about him, but you're also going to play him in part at a different position because Casey Gillespie, who's also going to the Fall League, is a priority guy, and he and Daniel Robertson, I guess part of the reason they're going to the Fall League is to catch up after some injuries cost them at-bats?
Well, there's no doubt. You know, you only have so many at-bats during the season, and with Casey's injury and Daniel's injury, you definitely want to make at-bats up. We knew, you know, we needed the priority player in Gillespie because he needed to make up at-bats. We're going to bring Bowers into instructionally to play a little left field, which he has had in the past, to give him some versatility. With Robertson, we're going to bring him into instruction to play a little second base, give him a little more, you know, versatility. And what that means is Danny Robertson's still a shortstop. You only get one priority player in the Arizona Fall League. Casey's, you know, sort of say one-dimensional first base. The other two can play other positions. This is how you get the other two to get out there and get more at-bats, and yet we're able to help them with versatility, which is so important toward major league team. You see Schaefer, Schaefer at third, Schaefer at first, Schaefer in the outfield. There comes a point where, you know, they need to explore this. And so we don't want them really to play in the big leagues at a different position for the first time.
Of the other kids who are headed to the Arizona Fall League, you've got one guy who's been a bullpen guy and he started. That's Buddy Borden. Is part of the reason to get him to the Fall League more innings or to see him at a higher level of competition?
Well, we want him to have a higher level of competition. I think he had a solid season, Buddy. I think there's more to grow with Buddy. And, you know, Buddy did a great job for us in backing up Stanek, backing up Guerrero, never complaining about his role. We wanted to help him and help his skill, and yet we wanted to reward someone who really was a good teammate. And hopefully this can take him to the next level as well, Neil.
Two of the other kids who are going that are pitchers have been working primarily in the bullpen, and one has had a really impressive year, and the other has performed very well, too. Tell me what you can about Brad Schreiber and Mike Franco.
Well, they're both competitive. Franco's in his first full season, and he's already in the Florida State League. We call him No-Nick. You know, he's one of those kids that's a stocky build. He doesn't look, you know, the part, so to say. Fastball 93, 91, slider 82, 81, but he competes and he throws strikes. Schreiber has come a long way because last year in Bowling Green, it wasn't a good year for him. We, by necessity, got him to our Charlotte ball club. He got better. He performed, put him in Double A. He performed there. He earned the right to go to the Arizona Fall League. And when you go there, it's the next level. When you play against the best of the best in the Arizona Fall League, this can really, really help a career.
And certainly I know it did with a guy we talked about earlier in the program, Kevin Kiermaier. Who is someone, maybe, Mitch, that we has really emerged that we haven't touched on? I mean, you mentioned the years of Blake Snell and Richie Schaefer, and certainly everybody's talking about that. But who should we be talking about more that's maybe a little unsung this year in the minor league system?
I don't know if Jamie Schultz is unsung, but this young guy has a big league right arm. His power fastball is 95 to 97. His curveball has great spin rate like a Nate Karns in the big leagues. A little deficient in command, you know, but he's come such a long way from Hudson Valley. And the stuff that he has, not many have. And we need to continue, you know, for his development. But I can see him down the road being a part of our big league staff one day.
And you guys have moved him fairly quickly. Again, he was only drafted a couple of years ago. A guy who has gotten a lot of wins this year and maybe is unheralded because of the class he came out of is Jake Faria. And he's now got 17 victories. He's got a terrific ERA. How has this kid grown up this year?
Well, it's like, and we all talk about Snell, and I'm remiss not talking about Jake Faria. I talked about Jamie Schultz. Jamie was a college player, which, you know, you can move a little bit faster. Jake was a high school sign, came in with some ability, but the potential to grow. He had the size, the potential for greater size, some strength, potential for greater strength. He had a projectable body, and you see, it's almost like Alex Cobb in the same way. That Double-A level, you know, for Alex Cobb got him over the hump in the Fall League. Faria, you know, is almost similar to him. You don't want to compare, but similar to Alex, and where he got bigger, he got stronger, his control got better, pitches got better, command got better. He has too many innings to go, say, to the Arizona Fall League, but he has made some really nice progress this year between A-ball and Double-A, Neil.
Mitch, great stuff. Good luck to your teams in the postseason, and we'll talk to you soon.
Great, Neil. Thanks for having me.
Again, that's Mitch Lukovich, Director of Minor League Operations, and we certainly appreciate his time and all of our guests on this show today, Matt Silverman, Mark Topkin, Danny Schaefer, as well as Daniel Nava. If you ever have something you'd like to hear on the show, all you have to do is tweet me at Neil Solons. For my producer, Jason Berenger, I am Neil Solons. Stay tuned. The pregame show for the Rays and Yankees coming up next on the Rays Baseball Network.